You are now listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC, so if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
It'll all be in my book, How to Get Rich Slowly, the Dees Casillas story.
Get ready for the Social Hour.
Live from Dees World Studios in San Antonio, Texas, this is The Social Hour. On today's show, comic book creator Jason Seibel. And now your host. He's grateful for daylight savings time because now he can get an extra hour of farming in every morning. Dees Casillas.
Malab Keen, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Dees. Welcome back to the program. And welcome back to the new championship team. Baby, LA, two years in a row. What a hell of a game! My God, I almost missed my set Saturday night trying to finish watching that game. So, congrats to the LA Dodgers for bringing home another championship. And whatever lab those Japanese made, Otani, and make a couple more. Throw a couple of the ladies in there for us over here in America. How about that? not that tall though. Not that tall. We don't need any. You know, we're already confused on guys and girls in America. Let's make it more more traditional Japanese. But thanks for hanging out, guys. We appreciate you being here as usual. Tell a friend if you like what you hear. Spread the mirth. Check us out on the Madness Entertainment Network. We are now streaming live on Roku every single week on the Madness Entertainment Network. Sorry, not live. We record this live, and then later it goes out. I don't do it live. I don't know that. Yeah, I have no idea when it comes out on Roku, honestly. I think it's Thursday afternoons now. But you'll find it. They've got lots of great content. Go check out the channel. Lots and lots of great stuff comes from the Madness Entertainment Network, and we have more content coming. I'm working on some more stuff for them. We're trying to figure out how to get one of my comedy specials up there and some more stuff. So, yeah, bookmark that page and check it out. Real quickly before we get in with our guests, guys, for me, go to deescomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network. Live shows. Lots of live shows coming up this for the end of the year. It's funny, I said after November 15th I was going to take the last 6 weeks of the year off. And it turns out that is not going to happen. guys, for comedy, I will be at Dan's Bar in Castroville, Texas on the 13th. I will be at Upstage Comedy Lounge on the 16th. And we're doing a show at Bandera Brewing on December 6th. I will be at Ranger Creek Distillery in San Antonio on the 27th. also Woodlawn Comedy Club on the 20th. I forgot about that. Lots of stuff coming up in the area. So check the website, check the Instagram, get some tickets, come out to a show. Grab tickets to that THC show at Upstage Comedy Lounge. That's a good one. That's a fun one. And yeah, other than that, Killstand number 3 coming soon. We got our last pages in the other day, so we're just getting that polished up, finished up, off to the printer, and ready to get that in your hot little hands. If you're in the San Antonio region for conventions, I will be at the Kings of Horror Convention in Schertz, Texas this weekend, the 8th and 9th, and the 15th at Comic Book Arts in San Antonio of San Antonio. CASA, my favorite convention of the year. Check that out. And then I'll be doing a signing at Half Price Books on Huebner on December 6th. So that's all San Antonio local stuff. If you're not in San Antonio, sucks to suck, or come visit, whatever. Anyway, that's it, guys, for the announcements. We are going to get in with our guest today. He is a comic book creator of the comic book Mercer. Number 3 is now available on Kickstarter. Number 1 and 2 available now. Please make some noise for Jason Seibel, everyone.
What up, Dees?
Hey, what's up, man? How you doing?
I'm good, brother. Appreciate you having me on this. I'm super stoked to be here. So it's really cool. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, man. I appreciate you taking the time to come on, man. It's
dude, I'm a federal worker by day. I'm furloughed, so I got nothing but time, bro.
Yeah, you're just kicking it now, man.
I'm living life what it would be like to be an actual comic creator, just staying home writing, but I'm not getting paid.
Is like a real comic creator then.
Yeah, it is like a real comic creator.
You know, the few, the proud, the unpaid.
That's it.
Just like our military right now, I guess. You're not getting paid, right? You're just hanging out.
I am not getting paid. I'm hanging out day, 33 or something. They're going for the record, I guess. Yeah. The record's 35 days, so they're going for the record is 35 days. We're at like 33, I think. So,
I think we're
going
to blow way past 35. I think at this point, let's just keep it shut down. What are we doing? What do we need?
For real, just anarchy. We don't need a government. We don't need to turn the lights on, whatever.
We've got our own grid here in Texas. We got our own grid. We got lots of guns. I feel like we'll be okay. We're fucked on water.
I don't know what part of town you live in, but I'm up north, and the water up here is, and they keep just dropping neighborhoods in like it's a bad playing of Sim City. So it's just block by block by block, and it's just like I don't know where the water's coming from. So
I don't know where the people are coming from. This is the thing that perplexes me, because where my parents live, kind of over by Alamo Ranch area in the new development, they bought a house over there a couple of years ago, and it was, all new development and, a couple hundred houses, and these things got, filled up. Then they're building some more houses out there, like another 180 houses. I'm like, where the hell are these people coming from? Cause you go to I get it. People are leaving Seattle. People are leaving LA and stuff like that. But you go to LA or Seattle, there's not less bodies there,
Right.
It's like they're just making more people. It's like just NPCs are just getting cranked out into the world. You walk into one of these houses and it's just somebody standing in a corner, just walking into a corner, just in the Matrix. Like Peter Thiel's just got them in their cyber jail.
It's crazy. If the election goes the way I think it's going to go to New York City tomorrow, I think we're going to have a whole other influx of people. So
yeah. Well, the crazy thing to me with that New York thing is a lot of what I think this is something that all politicians have, but I think Democrats really are short-sighted in this when they look at stuff like taxing the rich and stuff, which I'm not necessarily opposed to. $1 billion is a lot of, when one person in America has more money than the bottom 50%, that seems crazy. They want to tax these companies and the rich and stuff like that. It's like they can just drive an extra 20 minutes and live in Connecticut. That's such a tax haven. It would add 20 minutes onto their commute, right? I don't think people realize how easy it is for someone to do that, or someone to just be like, I move my residence here, I still have an apartment in Manhattan, but I live in Connecticut,
But the problem with the whole tax the rich initiative is there's still loopholes. That's one of the best video clips ever of Trump in the first debate when he ran the first time, was when he said, you're not going to close these loopholes because your donors use them, when he was talking to Clinton. And it's this, you know what I mean? And so until we get rid of the whole system listen, taxation is theft as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. I don't care if you make $100 a month or you make $1 million a month. Taking my money, I put a whole thing up on, you tax me when I make it, then you tax the house that I used, my money that you already taxed, and then you tax me at the store. It's all ridiculous. I'm all for a consumption tax. Get rid of the personal income tax. America spends $19 trillion a year mm-hmm. in goods and services. So you tax everything at 10% across the board, you're almost making your annual budget. Then tax businesses at 15% and you're operating in a surplus. I mean, I know I'm making it sound super easy It's probably way more complicated than that. But is it? Because that way you're getting your fair share from the billionaires, because a billionaire is going to buy a billionaire's worth of stuff and there's no loophole.
Right. You know what I mean?
And so anyway,
I agree with you. I like the consumption tax a lot more. I've been an advocate for stuff like that for a long time. I think, you know, it's just impossible to convince the people who would be affected by that most to vote for that. You know, it's like weird how that Congress always votes yes for their pay increase. You know, it's like, of course, what the fuck? You know, it's like if you got to vote how often your wife gave you a blowjob, you know, you're like, it would probably be more than what she would say, you know, like, like the number would be very like she would probably be like 0.5 times a month and you're somewhere around you're in triple digits already, you know, you're like you can't let them decide.
It's crazy. I mean, I don't know. It's nuts. It really, I don't know what the right answer is, but it's like a constitutional convention where the people literally take the power back. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
I mean, yeah, that's what it would take. And I think the problem with that is what it takes to even convene a constitutional convention is, it requires so much of a vote that people realize what that would mean. And, you know, you're not even going to get Democrats on board with that. You think like people like Nancy Pelosi or shit like that are going to want to lose this sweet ass position they have, like this cushy job? So, you know, why do you think people like Thomas Massie, you're so shit on, you know, one of the only honest guys in Congress, in my opinion,
Well, look at Fetterman right now. I mean, he has become, you know, he has become like public enemy number one for Democrats across the board, because he's the like really the only one that's crossing the aisle, right? And you listen to him, and I mean, he's got that sling blade kind of shtick going on, but it's like, I mean, the dude was crazy when he ran so far left that everybody's like, what is this guy? He has a stroke and now all of a sudden he's got common sense. Like, you know, is there something to that? Like, it's wild.
What happened? You know, brain works better now. It's all just too wild. I mean, I was talking to a guy this weekend and he was asking me about a bunch of stuff and how I felt. And I'm just like, I think the horse is too far out of the barn, you know, like, mm-hmm. I don't know if you can put that genie back in the bottle as far as, trying to unwind some of the things that we've done when it comes, well, not we, but the, you know, our politicians have done when it comes to,
for sure.
Power structure and taxation and everything. You know, I mean, I'm like a Ron Paul libertarian type of guy where it's like, you know, abolish the Fed. We don't need, you know, this type of shit. And it's just, again, you can't, the people in charge are the ones that get to decide what the rules are and how much they make and how much power they wield. It's like, yeah, of course they're going to, you know, make it advantageous for them.
Yeah, that's wild. I don't know. This whole thing has been nuts. I mean, I don't know, from both sides.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, you can't even get someone, most people, to have a measured, nuanced conversation with any actual thought of like what is on what, you know, any other thing but whatever their preferred news site is telling them to believe currently. Oh, did I lose you? Okay, you're back.
There you go. Okay, I think we're back. Yeah. Just getting ready to send you a message. No, see what happened. We started talking about them and they're shutting us down, dude.
What's it called? Palantir just linking into our program here, being like, what are you guys? You guys are having a little too much chitter chatter on the line there.
Dude, I'm telling you, we start talking about them and they're shutting the feed down, man. Yeah. It's just
well, and I mean you know, this is, that's one of the things that it seems crazy, but I mean, the set with the way the censorship shit's going, it's not that far off where they're like, we don't like what you guys are talking about. Shut her down. You know,
yeah, let's throttle back that internet connection.
Yeah. Let's take a look at that old social credit score.
Did you ever watch the Orville? So it's talking about the social credit score. So there's this episode of the Orville. So I loved it. I thought it was great. It was a straight Star Trek ripoff.
Yeah.
Like unabashedly a Star Trek ripoff. Sure. But there's an episode where they go to this planet that's like, you know, it's just like Earth, except everybody wears this little badge and it has your social score on it. So how many thumbs up you get, how many thumbs down you get. And if you get to a certain level, then, you know, they execute you or they take you off to the prison camp or whatever. And it's just like, you know, Seth MacFarlane can get a little preachy sometimes in his art, which is fine. I mean, it's his stuff, but it's just, I mean, that was a really good one. Like, it was pretty wild, like how, you know, somebody would say something and all of a sudden, you know, you'd see the thumbs up going all up and then, you know, so anyway.
I mean, it's funny, but we're really not that far from something of that nature, you know? It's like where, I mean, the first time I was like, this is really crazy overstepping is, you know, obviously during COVID, it got crazy with censorship. But I sent someone a direct message on Facebook. And we were talking about comic books and they wanted to see some comic books I had for sale. I said, when I get home, I'll shoot you some pictures. And it was a direct message in Facebook, DM. And I got banned from Facebook for a month because I said, I will shoot you some pictures. So they said that was like hate speech to say I was going to shoot. I'm like, this is how little context and like, you know, this is what, this, like, they're just like, oh, you said I'll shoot you. So that's violence. Like, I guess I'm talking about, like, it's a,
but you got to wonder, like, is that a person? Cause it can't be, I mean, nobody's that stupid, right? You would hope.
Yeah.
You know, so they're trusting the AI algorithm to pull those two keywords out.
Right.
And then, you know, I don't know. You'd think Zuckerberg, with all his billions, would have somebody that was able to like verify, like, oh, you know, I got banned one time for 30 days because me and my cousin were going back and forth on a post and talking about, you know, whatever. And I'm like, well, I'm gonna kick your ass. And instantly 30. And I'm like, that's my cousin. Like, we were just messing around. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is part of the problem, though. We run into this like where you know, it is the AI doing that, not a real person. And as the AI becomes more pervasive in all of that, the AI is now making a decision. And when it comes to AI making judgment, they're going to be like, hey, this guy's threatening to kill people. I have to call the cops. He's threatening to shoot people. And now the AI calls the fucking robot police who come knock down your door. And you've got to explain to them, no, I meant shoot him a picture. It's a colloquialism. And they're like, you said shoot. And then they're like, he has a gun. And then they shoot you. And then you're fucking.
Yeah. Now that you're, it's, dude, have you had a conversation with ChatGPT?
I don't fuck with AI.
No, at all? Mm-mm. Like, really?
Mm-mm. No.
So in my day job, I use it quite a bit to help with like data analytics stuff.
Yeah.
Just because I'm smart enough to kind of navigate the, you know, whatever, but like writing the code and stuff like that. I mean, it gets a little bit technical I use it to help because it's a huge time saver. Otherwise I'd have to literally figure out how to do it myself or whatever. So, but now ChatGPT has a feature that you can literally have a conversation with it. Like you hit the talk button and I mean, we could just be chatting and it will give you answer. I mean, it's like James Cameron spent the 80s warning us against this. Right. And now here we are, you know what I mean? Know. Like it's wild.
It's such a cliche and it's one of those things where it's almost so cliche and so like ingrained in our, you know, like 80s sci-fi brain that we just still think it's wacky and still think it's like you know, like, oh, it's, yeah, that's a, you know, a trope, and you're like, no, that's here.
No, it's real.
That's yeah. in your it's, pocket it's, every day.
It is. It's right now.
Yeah.
I mean, so I'm a huge anti-AI guy when it comes to any kind of art stuff, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's a couple different Facebook forums that I'm in where these dudes will post this soulless trash yeah. that – and I mean, like – and again, unabashedly, like not trying to hide it, like literally on the cover, written by, you know, John Smith, art by I think it's called Midjourney or something is the AI comic yeah. book creator program that they use. And I'm like, you're not even trying to hide that you're a computer, you know. I mean, and it is garbage. It's getting better, which yeah. is scary.
Yeah.
But it is garbage. And, you know, I will troll, I will flame, I will, like, dude, you are posting garbage in this forum, like, admin, you know, get this dude out of here kind of stuff. And it's just like, and a lot of them let him stay, which surprises me, like, that as comic creators, mm-hmm. whether in the indie world or in the pro world, that we're not more united against... You know, I think most of us are, but I mean, there are those out there that are like, yeah, well, the guy can't afford an artist. Okay, well, then you don't fucking get to create yeah, a comic book then.
Right, right. I mean, because, you know
I can't afford an artist, but I still yeah. figure it out. yeah. I'm still yeah. paying my artist.
There's still someone out there who's getting paid. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it is interesting because, like, this last, I don't remember what convention it was. Maybe New York. Maybe that convention in Spain that just happened. But Jim Lee came out and had yeah. this big thing about yep. against AI. And you're like which is great. Except and I say this with reverence for Jim Lee. He's just pissing the way the wind is blowing, because a couple years ago when AI was kind of new on the art scene. There was him talking. He was talking about how, like, oh, it'd be cool to do have AI of my art, so my family can make more of my art and have me around, right. Make money off my product forever. So you're like, do you feel this way, or are you just there's so much pushback in the industry that you have to be like, okay, I'm just giving in to what the way people are sure. feeling right now.
Well, but to that point, like. I mean, I think everybody should get their own choice, right? If Jim Lee wants to get with an AI developer and say, I want you to create an AI algorithm that will recreate my art. So if little Jim Lee Jr., I don't know what his kids' names are, but, goes and daddy's long gone and he's like, man, I really wish I had a picture of Batman fighting, whatever. And he can type into this thing, draw a picture of Batman fighting Deadpool like my daddy would have drawn it. And it recreates it, then I mean, I think that that's Jim Lee's choice if Jim Lee wants to do that. Mm-hmm. But what is bullshit about the whole thing is that I can go right now on any one of these programs and type, give me a picture of Deadpool fighting Batman and draw it like Jim Lee. And now it steals that, art concept from the thousands and thousands and thousands of images right. that are out there of Jim Lee. And it creates that. And it's not perfect yet. I mean, but like I said, from where it was a year ago, it's getting a lot better.
Oh, it's leaps and bounds. Yeah.
Better, right? So, you don't see six-fingered, right. the six-fingered characters anymore, or the Superman S that's kind of cockeyed or whatever. Like, it's crazy. But like I said, there are, to me, there are certain applications of it, but it's just like, it's that slippery slope of like, I'm not the art stuff. I think the art stuff's garbage, but I mean, like just the chat bots and so on. I mean, there are, and it's everywhere. It's yeah. everywhere right now.
Oh yeah. I mean, anytime you get on anything, you're like, am I talking to a real person? Is this,
yeah.
is this genuine? Well, because I mean, it's like, what the hell's the guy's name? I forget the guy's name who, you're familiar with like the dead internet theory. What the hell is this guy's name? Why am I forgetting it? It's this like engineer guy, and he did all this study, and he thinks that over 80% of the basically people on the internet aren't even real. That most of the internet is like, it's just complete, it's just bots or, you know, bot farms or AI. You know, you like the, you've seen these pictures of guys on a computer with like 100 screen, you know, mm-hmm. just, and it's those type of things. These aren't real people, real accounts.
It's the, it's the monkeys from Superman, from yeah, Clone Superman.
Yeah, like. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the outrage monkeys. Just but I mean, you know, and you're like, so yeah, it's like this isn't this world we're all so entrenched in every day. It's like, it's, you know, if you're on some random page, like, you know, not someone specifically you know in real life, like, mm-hmm. there's a great chance this might not even be a real fucking person you're engaging with, you know?
Which is crazy to think about, like, because, I mean, like you said, you know, going back to the James Cameron thing or whatever, like, we're from that time where, you know, as being a Gen Xer, are you Gen X? We're about the same age, aren't we?
I don't know. I'm 43.
Are you? Oh, yeah. I'm 48. So, I mean, we're in that last generation that remembers life without all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah,
we were the first ones to log into the internet. I don't know what your first internet memory is, but I remember my job when I was a senior in high school is I was a DJ. I got a job at a radio station.
Okay.
As a DJ. The overnight Friday and Saturday nights on a country AM country station.
Wow.
Bro, I had three listeners.
Yeah.
Two of them were cows. I mean, and I'm not talking about big women. Well, I mean, yeah. I'm talking about actual cows.
Not an avalanche of pussy with that gig.
Well, you'd be surprised, actually. Because when you're a high school kid and you're like, oh, you know, everybody else is working at Burger King or Taco Bell, and you're working at, you know, you're like, I'm on the radio. Because everybody, once word got out, then, and, you know, as most, you know, radio DJs, I had to have a radio name. And so I was Jason Holiday, the Midnight Cowboy.
There you go.
Because nice. Tombstone had just come out and I was going by the name Jay Holiday, or no, I'm sorry, I was going by the name Jay Montana, and they said, that's the stupidest name we've ever heard. You need to come up with something else. And so I said, all right, well, I'm Jay Holiday. And they said, all right. So I was Jason Holiday, the Midnight Cowboy, on a AM country station in Great Falls, Montana, which is where I grew up. So,
oh, good old Great Falls, man. Wow.
Coldest, and the G-Funk.
Coldest place I've ever been. I used to, when I lived in Western Montana briefly in my mid-teens, and I played basketball. And one year I was in Great Falls, Montana, and with wind chills like negative 47 degrees or some shit.
It's crazy.
Terrible.
People don't get it, man, especially here, right? Like in Texas. I mean, yeah, I know we got listeners all over, but here it's just they don't understand. I mean, it was, you know, in the high 30s, low 40s this morning, and people are like, oh, my God, it's cold. And I'm like, yeah, it's chilly for here.
Right.
But you don't understand cold until you walk outside and your nose freezes together.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's wild. But yeah, so that's where I grew up. I was born and raised in Great Falls, Montana, and then left home when I was 18, joined the Air Force, and then kind of lived everywhere. So yeah. And then ended up settling here after I retired from active duty. So
you were serving in San Antonio, I assume.
So at one point, yeah. So I jumped all over. I lived. Let's see. I'll go through the list real quick. So I left home in Montana. Went to Monterey. Well, came to San Antonio for basic training, as everybody does. Went to Monterey, California for almost a year. I was doing language training. I originally enlisted to be a linguist, so I was in Arabic school to learn Arabic.
Okay.
That didn't go. I ended up washing out. It was tough. It was a hard school. So then came back here to San Antonio. Did security. Law enforcement training. I was in the Air Force, they call it security forces, but military police, it's the same thing. So did that training here and then went to Patrick Air Force Base, which is Cocoa Beach, Florida. You ever been to Cocoa Beach?
I don't think so. Yeah. Which side of Florida is that on?
It's on the coast. It's on the coast side, on the Pacific or on the Atlantic side.
No, I've been through like Naples and Fort Myers.
Okay.
And
gotcha. So it's just south of Daytona, but it's like where they do the shuttle launches, right?
Got it.
Cape Canaveral is Patrick Air Force. But anyway, okay. So was there. Then I went to Washington, Spokane, your old neck of the woods there. Yep, Fairchild Air Force Base. Yeah, so I was there for a couple years. Then I went to Korea the first time. Spent a year in Korea.
North or south?
South, man. Okay, nobody goes to North Korea.
Gotta ask,
if you do, you don't come back. I tell a lot of people, like, I didn't go to college. Everybody, you know, my friends went to college. I went to Korea. Korea was my college experience. It's like, it's this, what you see in the movies, like with the bars and the girls and the, you know, that's literally what Korea is like. At least it was when I was there. It's much tamer now.
Yeah.
You know, all the human trafficking stuff. And human trafficking is a horrible thing and it's real. But I mean, back then we weren't really thinking about it. It was, you know, Juicy, you ever hear about Juicy Girls? You want me to tell you about Juicy Girls? You know what that is?
Yeah, sure. I don't. I can do some math, but let's hear it.
So in Korea, back then, and this is like late '90s, early 2000s, they had these bars for the GIs that were called Juicy Bars. So the concept, and they bring these girls in, a lot of Filipinos. That's where they brought a lot of them in from. But from other, like, there was Russian girls, there was Cuban girls, right? So they bring these girls in and they're basically indentured servants. They get there, they take their passport away, and they pay them, and then there's, because they're sending money home to their families or whatever. But their whole gig, it's not prostitution. There's no sex acts per se, but it's because the GIs are over there on an unaccompanied tour and they're lonely. So they go in these bars, these young kids, 18, 19, 20 years old, they sit down, the girls will come over, pay attention to you as long as you buy a juice. And it's literally like a little shot glass of juice, and it's $10. And so basically for every, as long as they're sitting there drinking the juice, they can sit on your lap and rub up on you and do the thing, right? But as soon as you stop buying them juices, then here comes the little old Korean lady with three teeth in her head and her eyes all like this, and she'll pull them off and take them to the next GI. So you've got to keep buying the juice in order to have the girl sit there and pay attention. And I mean, I've seen some of these kids lose their minds over these girls because they're hot.
Oh yeah,
and these kids are lonely, you know. And it's just like, oh, but she loves me. But does she though? Yeah. And so, anyway, why the hell was I talking about Juicy Girls? Anyway, so that was Korea, right? That was my Korea experience. So, then I came back from Korea. I was in DC for a little while at Andrews Air Force Base. I was actually there for 9/11, the DC sniper, the anthrax stuff. I was stationed there for all of that. Like, probably the worst time to be stationed in DC since like the War of 1812 when they burned down the White House. Like, it was horrible. and then where the hell did we go? Oh, then we went to Montana. So I was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, which is right there in Great Falls. Yeah. I was there for a while. And then I got divorced from my first wife while I was there, went back to Korea for a year, then went back to Fairchild, met my wife now. And then we came here to San Antonio, spent like 4 years here, 3.5 years here, went back to Montana, got stationed back at Malmstrom. My kids were there from my first marriage, and then retired and then came back here to San Antonio. So that was kind of the, and then during all that time, spent time in Iraq, spent time in Afghanistan, served in both of those theaters. And so, yeah, I've been all over.
Yeah. So. Damn. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, crazy, crazy, crazy stuff over there. My cousin was we're the same age, grew up together, and he joined the Marines when he turned 18. He did, two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan as an LRV scout. And he was frontline when they, you know, stormed Fallujah, stuff from the first platoons to go in. And it's funny, he always tells me, you know, because I always ask him about it, especially when we used to drink together. I would be like, I'm like curious, and I'm one of the few people he would open up to about it. And I'm like, what was the biggest difference between those places? He goes, in Iraq, he goes, the people were grateful and wanted us to be there. In Afghanistan, everyone wanted to kill us.
I find that to be very, very accurate, actually. When I was in Iraq, I was in Baghdad, and like it was called the IZ, the International Zone. So you always see the big cross swords, right? Yeah. The picture of that, like, yeah. So that's right where we were. It's like a 5 square mile area in downtown Baghdad. And then there was all of these little outposts called FOBs, right? Forward operating bases that were all in that area, Army and Marines. And then you had like the Brits were here and the, you know, whatever, right? And so
the three Canadians and an Australian guy over in the corner.
For real. I mean, absolutely.
Like, thanks for your help, Canada. Your four guys on mooses will really do it.
But they were super cool, though. Yeah. Super cool. Yeah. And they always had beer. Anyway. And then there was an Australian sniper that I met. He was pretty cool. Anyway. So the job I was doing while I was there, because like I said, I was military police. So we were the IZ police, which was like being the sheriff in the Wild Wild West at that point. Because like Blackwater was still operating, right? Those contractors that were all like, you know, just hyped up on steroids and, you know, like pre-workout nonstop. It was crazy. And you'd leave one of the little FOBs to go to the next FOB, and then you're driving through a neighborhood in downtown Baghdad, and the kids are running up to you and stuff, and you're throwing them Gatorade and, you know, the peanut butter from the MREs, and, you know, we always had candy in the back of the trucks and stuff, but it's like, you know, you'd see them and they were always happy to see us, Afghanistan, not so much. Like you said, it was like, how can we get a bomb in there to kill these guys? It was a very, very different experience.
Wild, that whole thing. What a crazy, I mean, that's a long story, but what a mess. And I mean, that's, you know, 22 years or whatever we were dug into that, trying to,
and it's wild.
At what point did you get into comic books as a fan? And then we'll move into like as a creator, but like as a fan, was it as a kid you were, you know, cause growing up in Great Falls, Montana, I assume there was, you know, maybe one pharmacy that had a spinner rack or something. What do you, you know?
So I love, it's a great question, bro. And thanks, because I love this story. So when I was like 9, and I've got a younger brother that's 2 years younger than me. So, and he was like 7. We somehow found G.I. Joe. Where we grew up right there in Great Falls, like 3 blocks away, there was a Circle K and it had a spinner rack. And, you know, I think probably one day we were in there, mom was getting gas or whatever, and we saw it and started reading G.I. Joe. And of course, you know, G.I. Joe, we had the toys and we were always, you know, that was kind of our childhood, right? But we would walk the 3 blocks every month, right, to the Circle K, and we would take turns with our allowance. 1 month I would buy it, the next month he would buy it. You're, you know, and that
socialism
was how
it work.
What's that?
So I said this is one of the only ways socialism works.
With your brother buying comics. that was where it started. Was reading G.I. Joe. And I remember I was probably about 11 maybe. And we were in Cub Scouts, and we went to this like Cub Scout camp in the summertime. And there was a kid there that had a G.I. Joe comic that I didn't have. It predated when we had started buying them. And I was like, oh my God, like I'd never seen it before. I didn't know it existed. And so I traded him like some patches or whatever, right? And I got this comic. And I think I probably read that issue, you know, 47 times on the time it took to drive from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho back to Great Falls, Montana. But I had asked him, I was like, well, you know, we started buying on this issue and I didn't know that this, and he goes, well, why don't you just go to the comic book store? And I'm like, what the fuck is a comic book store? And he's like, you've got to have a comic book store in your town. And I'm like, so literally, like, I mean, we get home, and I mean, I don't even say hi to my mom, drop my bags, and I run in and I grab the yellow pages, right? Yeah. And I'm flipping through them, and there was a comic book store. It was called Marvel Us Comics. And it was right, you know, right there down the road. And so I'm like, you got to take us to this place. My mom's like, you haven't even unpacked yet. I'm like, I don't care. We got to go. And after that, dude, it was over. Like, it was X-Men. It was Punisher. It was, you know, anything with an X in it, Punisher, like those were mine. My brother got into Spider-Man real big, Ghost Rider. And so, but then I got a paper route. So I had more money to spend on comics. Yeah. And it was like, But that's where it started. And that was pretty hot and heavy right up like through high school. And then when I joined the Air Force, I kind of fell out of it. You know, I kind of aged out a little bit. Sure. I was, you know, like, and I got married young. I mean, I got married at 18 years old and joined the Air Force. And so, wasn't as much time for it, but, got back into it in like the early 2010s, like right around the new 52 stuff with DC, probably just before all of that happened.
I think that was 2011. So
right in that area. And then kind of fell back out, but then really, really got back into when House of M and House of X and all that stuff came out here. What is that? Like 5 years ago at this point? It was COVID. Yeah, right before COVID. I got back into it and then kind of really, really, really started kind of beefing up my collection and stuff. I'm like, I have adult money now that I can just go spend on stuff that I've always wanted.
I can
do
this.
So I've been in, so that from the collecting reading aspect of it, that's kind of really where it all started.
Do you remember what your first issue of G.I. Joe was?
You know, I don't, and I wish that I did. Like, I wish that I could just go, no, it was this one right here. But it was like, I want to say probably in like the, probably the low 50s. I'm not sure.
Okay. You think if you saw it, you would recognize it, or you just,
in the annals of time now, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But that's where it all, like I said, now, so as an adult, right, one of my first goals is like, because I didn't have the full run, the 1 to 155. So I have it now, right? I've gone back and I've gotten 1 to 155, in fact. That's nice. The 155 there. 9.2. And it's signed by Larry Hama. Wow. So
I found a copy of that book in Vancouver, Washington last year. And it was only like $30, right? And because it's a pretty expensive book, it's hard to find. It's low, low
print. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh damn, like, that's a pretty good deal. And I go, can I pull this out and look at it? And I looked at it, and the cover was completely split and detached. So they had both sides of the cover, but I'm like, oh, that's why it's so.
Yeah,
and
I'm like,
I'll just hold out for.
That's the second copy of it I had. My sister-in-law actually bought me a copy of it a couple years ago for Christmas, but it had a big tear in the cover. So it was very affordable. And so she had bought it for me for a Christmas present. I'm like, oh, it's awesome. But then Heroes and Fantasies here in San Antonio, quick shameless plug for those guys. But I saw that and I'm like, as the final, because it was the final one I needed for the collection. Yeah. So as the final piece, I'm like, yeah, this is pretty cool. So
hard to pass it up.
So that's where the collecting and the reading stuff. And then, because I like to read. I mean, I'm a collector for sure. Like I'm going back trying to fill holes and runs. And right now my thing, well, once my paycheck gets turned back on, it's tough to collect right now. But I'm trying to go back and do all of the early Punisher appearance stuff. I'm a big Punisher fan. So I've got the original, the volume 2 run, which was his long run, number one to 105, I think, or whatever it was. So I've got that full run. But I'm trying to go back like the early Amazing Spider-Man stuff and everything is what I'm trying to fill in now. But I read monthly stuff and you and I have talked about this obviously in the different stuff that we've, you know, kind of met each other at. Like, I'm a firm believer, and I read this actually, I took a creative writing class a long time ago, and the textbook for the class was, it was Stephen King's On Writing, the nonfiction book he wrote about how to be a writer.
Yeah.
And the big thing that he says in that book is, in order to be a good writer, you've got to be a good reader. Mm. And you have to read, especially in the genre that you're trying to write. And so I'm a firm believer that if you want to write good comic book stories, you have to read good comic book stories. So yeah. I try to read, I try to read stuff, and I've got a pull list. And
I think like reading good comic book stories is very important, but I also am a huge advocate for, because I did this with comedy too, because for a long time after I started comedy, because I was such a comedy fan, and then I was doing comedy, I actually stopped watching and listening to other comedy, because I didn't want that to bleed in to me. Like, I wanted to figure out my voice, not be an emulation of someone else's voice. So, you know, you kind of have to be stable enough in your voice to then be able to integrate good stories without emulating. But also, I'm such a big advocate of, like, digging into other mediums. Like, I, you know, people always ask me when I'm doing interviews about my work, like, what creatively, like, what are your inspirations? I go, probably more outside of comic books than inside. You know, like, I'm a huge fan of, like, Kurt Vonnegut, Chuck Palahniuk, like, their books, things like that, or, like, Stanley Kubrick films. I take a lot of inspiration from things like that. Like, that's the stuff that I want to take from mediums outside of what I'm working on, and how do I apply that to this craft, you know?
It's funny because, and you're a writer too, so, you know, I don't know what other mediums that you've tried to write in. Obviously, you've kind of got, you know, your hand in a bunch of different cookie jars. And I mean, so I published a novel on Amazon. That was like my first real big, like, writing undertaking, and right in COVID, like 2020, 2021, I published a novel called He Said, She Said on Amazon through their self-publishing thing. And that was, I mean, that was quite an exercise in really in discipline, because I literally got up and wrote 1500 pages every morning from 4 a.m. to 5 a.m. before I got my day started with my day job. Right. I would get up every morning and write 1500 words. Did I say 1500 pages? I meant 1500 words.
I knew what you meant. Like, yeah, this guy's cranking it out. Like, this guy's writing. He's kissing.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it was really like, can I do it? Because I've been writing since I was a kid, right? I was always, I would, you know, I, first grade, I was writing, my best friend at the time, his name was Neil Kimball. And I would write these stories called Jason and Neil Bond in the Case of the Missing Ruby, right? And they were just these like little one-page stories in the first grade. And I'd ask the teacher, you know, can I get up and read my story in front of the class? Like, so I was doing that from a very young age. And then they kind of just expanded. And I was like, man, you know, I really want to write a novel. And so I wrote a novel. But I enjoyed it, but it was a very, very long process. But I've written screenplays, which I think is very, obviously very similar to writing comic books, that. But nothing's ever really gone anywhere. And it's, you know, so with the comic book stuff, it was just kind of like, there wasn't really a one defining, like, I'm going to make a comic book, but I kind of just started, you know, I had this idea for Mercer, which it started out as a very different idea. But it kind of just was toiling around in the back of my mind. I was actually on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, one day. And, I saw this guy, his name's David Van Dyke, who's actually done variant covers for this. He's credited as the co-creator of Mercer. And now with issue 3, he's actually now the interior artist on Mercer. But he had tweeted something about would love to draw a G.I. Joe story. And I didn't follow him, didn't know him, you know, had no idea. And so, you know, I kind of just responded to his tweet. You still call them tweets if it's not Twitter?
I feel like we, you know, what do you,
right,
I still do.
Responded, it's like, yeah. All right, cool. So responded to his tweet and was like, yeah, I said, I'd love, and this was a couple years ago. So this is when when IDW had lost their G.I. Joe license, when they finished at issue 29 or 300 or whatever it was, right? Before it started at Skybound Image, which is where it's at now.
Yeah.
And they hadn't really announced like what was going to happen with the G.I. Joe license. And so I was like, man, I have this great idea for a G.I. Joe reboot, like to bring it into the, you know, 21st century, whatever. And so this guy, David, and we're friends now. So it's weird to refer to him as this guy, but he messaged me back and he was just like, what do you got? And so I had written this G.I. Joe script, which now it's funny. Are you reading any of the new G.I. Joe stuff, like the Energon
stuff? Not really. I'll pick up the, not the Energon version, but Larry Hama's occasionally, just because I like, you know, it's fun, and also the Andy Kubert covers grab me.
Oh, they're awesome. Yeah, very good.
I didn't really get into Joshua Williams. I picked up the first two issues and just didn't grab me. Transformers, I've dipped in and out of. It's just, it hasn't totally grabbed me. So I'm pretty much of the point where if I'll give a book one, maybe two issues, and if I'm not super into it, I don't know, I've got too much else.
No, well, yeah, I mean, you got to budget your time and your money, right? If you had $5 a book, like, you just, and I fall into that trap where I'll keep buying a $5 book every month just because, like, X-Men is supposed to be on my pull list. It's always been on my pull list. I finally have taken the X-Men needle out of my arm and stopped, you know.
Yeah, see, but I used to be the same way. So, at some point, you just got to, and, you know, I've heard it's great, though, so.
So I was on, I read them both. So I read the Hama version and I read the Daniel Warren Johnson version too. The Energon stuff, but the Energon stuff is very much like they're two completely different universes. Right. Yeah. And so, but it's kind of like if they hired Jason Seibel at Skybound to reboot G.I. Joe, it's kind of the direction I would have gone. Not to say, you know, that Daniel Warren Johnson Josh Williamson copied anything from me or anything like that. But I wrote this script that was very much like these dudes go in to do like this prison rescue of their comrades. And like the prison guard the prison warden is the guy that ends up being Cobra Commander. And he's got his henchman is Captain Blood, right? To later to be Major Blood and all this stuff. And so anyway, so I sent this script to David Van Dyke, and he was like, man, he's like, you're really a good writer. Like so he starts telling me, you know, he's done some stuff. He did inking, you know, he learned, worked for Image at one point and did some inking stuff in under Robert Kirkman and through some of his stuff and worked on when they did the Guardian stuff coming out of Invincible and stuff like that. And so, and he's done work for Dark Horse. He did a variant cover when Kevin Smith was doing his Quick Stops books here. He did, there was a variant cover where it had all the different versions of Dante, all the different Dantes, right? So he did a variant cover with all the Dantes on it. And so anyway, we kind of just developed this friendship, and he was like, man, you know, he's like, you're a really good writer. You know, what else do you have that's not licensed that, you know, you might want to do? And so I kind of pitched him this idea of Mercer and kind of what the premise was or whatever. And he's like, yeah, I kind of dig it. And so we kind of started down this road, and then a paying gig for him came up. And so he kind of was like, well, I can't really, you know, really work on it right now. I don't really have a whole lot of time. And so I ended up, you know, finding an artist, a European artist on Facebook, as a lot of us have done.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the first two issues of Mercer. And then, but David always kind of kept his hand, you know, we signed a deal with him having, you know, the creator credit, because he did kind of help me develop the character and stuff. So, just with issue three, the artist that I was using, Raphael is his name. He wasn't meeting the deadlines that I wanted him to meet, and he had some other stuff going on. And so I kind of turned back to David and said, hey, you know, I don't know what you got going on right now, but, this is what I'm paying Raphael. I'd be happy to pay you the same rate to, you know, work on this book. And he graciously jumped back in. So that's kind of how that whole thing happened. So
nice. I'm curious, you don't have to, you know, reveal more than you'd like to regarding this, but with the creator credit, so is there like is it a shared ownership then, or just he, what's, cause I guess I'm thinking like if someone else wanted to buy it, or someone was licensing it for a film, you know, or, you know,
No, it's a great question. And it's something that he and I have talked actually quite in depth about. So when we were developing what eventually became Mercer, the character's name was Adam Stryker. It was the same profession. All the things were the same, but kind of the direction that I took the story and how that I changed significantly. So when he kind of came back around and I said, hey, you know, because he and I launched a Kickstarter 3 years ago that just went nowhere because I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea how to run a Kickstarter, how to manage a campaign, how to, you know, and it kind of just died. Well, then I kind of resurrected it, turned it into Mercer, found this other artist. And so he and I had a conversation. And so he owns, and it's not a 50-50 split. He owns a percentage of the character so that if, you know, if Netflix, you know, calls me and says, hey, we saw this book, we'd like to do a 5-part miniseries or whatever, then whatever percentage of whatever the profits were, he would get that percentage of the profits.
Okay.
So
minority stake.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, like I said, we've signed contracts, and my publishing company, which is Alamo City Comics, you know, I have an LLC, and so we've signed contracts through that. So I mean, it's a legit deal where he's you know, it was like he gets this percentage, and he will be always be kind of like the Jerry Siegel and you know, thing. He'll always be listed as a co-creator in the credits of the book and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So
okay,
yeah.
For the listeners, give us an elevator pitch on Mercer, elevator pitch, and then we'll go into a little more depth.
Okay, sounds good. So Mercer is a New York City detective who, as the story unfolds, you find out that he has this ability to see demons as they walk the earth. So demons are here, they're inhabiting people, but the normal layman can't see them. They just think that these people are bad or whatever, and Mercer, he sees them as they are the demon, not as they are the person. So there's this this evil, ancient evil. His name's Utakarn, and he's this ancient Sumerian blood god, and he's has possessed this serial killer, and he's trying to come through, open a portal. And so Mercer and his new partner, Madison Cook, and then they meet this kooky, like, master of mystic arts. His name's Aidan McLeod, and so they're trying to stop this demon invasion. But it's very much... you know, it's very much a 80s buddy cop kind of deal, like, you know, kind of a Lethal Weapon kind of, you know, feel, but with that mystic, you know, like a John Constantine kind of, you know, twist to it. So, yeah.
And then what is it? Your third issue is coming out soon. You're running the Kickstarter. I think it's still going on right now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we're about halfway through. Yeah.
And what's the plan long term for it? I mean, are you looking at finite series, ongoing? What's the plans?
So right now, the story that I'm telling is 5 issues. That's this first, kind of the first arc that really kind of introduces the world. And I've got the 5 issues. Well, I mean, yeah. So I've got the 5 issues outlined out, right? I've got that story, which has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
But it's kind of left open at the end of issue 5 to where if we wanted to keep going, if there's, you know, were something that would, you know, happen that we would be able to keep going. I've got some other stuff that I'm working on, you know, some other stories, you know, that I'd like to explore too. So I don't want to pigeon myself into Mercer forever. Yeah. But like I said, you know, hey, I mean, if Kirkman shows up with that Skybound money and he's like, hey, man, I'll write Mercer until they'll tell me to stop.
Turns out I have a lot more ideas for Mercer.
Exactly. So, I mean, I've got an idea for a second story arc already that I could easily jump into. But the goal was always from the beginning, from the start of the first Kickstarter with the first issue, was to do a 5-issue kind of mini series and see what happened from there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's smart too, because I, you know, I'm sure you get this too, doing conventions and you know, when people find out you create your own comic books, people talk to you about their ideas and what they're, you know, I have this, I want to do this thing. And, you know, they ask for advice and they ask for your thoughts and stuff. And the biggest thing I always tell people, I'm like, man, you know, like people start telling you generally about this, big idea, and it's a sprawling epic, and it's, you know, 300 issues, and it's like, you know, token-esque in its world building.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that sounds great. I go, don't do that to start. Like, fine, you know, I'm like, that, you know, it's like, you know, do that when you're better at this. Do that when you have an audience that'll hang on for that ride. But like right now, find something that's digestible, you know, that you can say this is 5 issues, 8 issues, 10, 12 issues even. Like, but I mean, not, you know, even that's starting to stretch into where you're like, you know, something that you can say has a beginning, middle, and end, and you have a body of work someone can look at and a complete story, you know?
The other piece of it too is, right, like, I mean, I love having my own label for what that's worth and whatever, but like, I mean, let's be honest, Alamo City Comics isn't paying for itself at this point. Right. You know what I mean? So, you know, kind of the thought process is we finish the 5 issues, we roll them into a trade. You know, now there's a possibility of getting into big bookstores. You know, you can sell a trade to I almost said B. Dalton's. Wow, there's a blast from the past. But Barnes and Noble. You remember B. Dalton's?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah. Walden Books is going to pick it up. And
Walden Books. Oh, yeah. Dude, I spent a lot of time in Walden Books in the Holiday Village Mall in Great Falls. Shout out Holiday Village Mall. But you know, but also to look at some of these indie comic, you know, I mean, whether it's an Image or a Mad Cave or, you know, one of these publishing labels that take submissions, you know, yeah. I've just in talking to the industry, I say industry professionals, because, you know, I mean, yes, I say comic creator like I'm talking about those guys, but yes, I am a comic creator too. It's kind of one of those things I got to remember. But you talk to the industry professionals and they'll tell you it's a lot easier to sell something if you have something that's already done, right? Like if you're trying to pitch something to Image and you say, I've got 5 issues that are ready to go now, the risk to them is significantly reduced because, you know, they're going to get those 5 issues. Now, if they don't sell, they don't sell. And that's a whole nother story. But I mean, if they have 5 issues that are done and a trade ready to go, then it's a little bit more palatable. So,
The marketing and the finances just make more sense, you know?
No, 100%. And so, you know, and so that's something that I want to look at too. Once we finish the 5 issues of Mercer is, you know, is there a market to, you know, is there a path through Image or through Mad Cave or through one of these other companies to, you know, to have them distribute it. So
And that's really smart. That I think a lot of people don't understand. I mean, I've had the same conversation with a lot of people too, where they're like, well, I've got this idea and I'm going to submit it to Image. And I'm like, that's great. I'm like, you can like check that box to say you did. It'll just make your pitch and the way you the tightness of your pitch of your book better doing that. But understand that like, they're taking your pitch and your couple pages you have maybe to whatever James Tynion is also wants to do, you know?
I mean, so look at the names on Image Books right now. You got Jeff Johns is doing a book at Image. You got Mark Waid is doing, you know, like you said, Tynion's. I mean, these are guys and girls that have stuff. You know, they have a name already. So you're competing against that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and trust me, that's not lost on me too. I mean, even if I have a fully done project to say, hey, you know, I still fully realize that, you know, that the chance of them saying no is a lot greater than the chance of them saying yes. So, I mean, but this is kind of for me too, right? Like I'm kind of a completionist. Like I could not finish on issue 3 and be like, okay, and just never tell the rest of the story.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
One way or the other, it's going to get made, you know. I mean, even if it's a print run of 1 just for me to, you know, I mean, it's still going to be done. So,
you're, people need to understand they're not submitting projects in a vacuum. They're submitting them in a world of competing against people with a fan base. But my point going back to your point also was that, if you create a project and you have it completed and you've created some sort of real proof of concept, some tangible thing, and also some sort of fan base, you know, whether whatever size that may be, but people, you know, you've completed a couple of Kickstarters, you've sold books, you're in some comic book shops. I mean, those things that, you know, like, I'm sure to you and to me also, you're like, yeah, yeah, okay, Heroes and Fantasies carries my book. Like, that's great. I'm not, you know, I'm selling, you know, 10 books in 3 months. You know, I'm not like, it's not, you know, which is great. I'm happy, but I'm not selling, you know, it's not like it goes out on Wednesday and they sell 40 copies.
But it
still does say a lot. And mean a lot, I think, even as you slowly, incrementally climb up the ladder to places like Mad Cave Vault and stuff like that. Like, they do see that as like, okay, this guy was able to do this on his own, get into some shops. He's completed a miniseries. We can look at that as, you know, an idea of whether we use this or maybe you're willing to look at his next project. Like, those do mean things, you know?
I'll tell you, man, probably one of the coolest moments in this whole journey, it was the last Heroes and Fantasies little, you know, our local, what do they call it, indie creator spotlight things that they did. There was a dude that came in, walked right over to my table and was like, hey, man, I bought your book at the first one. He goes, when I saw they were doing a second one, I had to come to get the next issue because I really liked the first issue and I came here specifically to buy. I mean, dude, I'm like, I feel like Stan fucking Lee, man. Like I was like, Excelsior, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, and like you said, you know, I sold what, I think 15 copies at that, you know, showcase. And I mean, I felt fantastic. And I know that there's guys that are doing way more than that, you know, but, and that's okay. You know, I mean, is there stuff better than mine? I mean, maybe it is. They, you know, whatever, maybe it's not. And they just have, you know, the hustle is there. I don't have the bandwidth in my life to go do this full time. Yeah. Right. I mean, I've got mouths to feed. I've got two kids at home and stuff like that. So kind of the, you know, the level that I'm able to do it is the level that I'm comfortable at doing it. And I fully understand that. Yeah. Right. Like, if I was able to go out on the road and do, you know, 4 cons a week or, you know, whatever, like, not, there's probably not 4 cons a week going on, but you know what I mean? Yeah. Like 4 cons a month, you know, and stuff. But like, I'm doing Comic Art San Antonio. I mean, that's because you actually told me about that. And then I signed up for a table and they were full. And then actually just out of the blue, got an email that they had a table come open.
Nice.
And so, yeah. And so I'll be there in 2 weeks, the 15th here in San Antonio. Yeah. So, you know, and it's like 5 days with the Kickstarter still happening, so I'll be able to maybe plug that and get. Kickstarter's been slow on this one. I think a lot of it I'll attribute it to the shutdown. We'll have a full circle moment here because a lot of my fan base and a lot of the backers that I had on the first two issues to Kickstarter are all our friends and family. I mean, which is how a lot of Kickstarters go. I think.
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends are military or government civilian employees, and you know, without a guaranteed paycheck, there's just not a whole lot of bandwidth even to spend, you know, 12, 15 bucks on a Kickstarter. And I get it. I mean, so, hey, motherfuckers, open the government. You're impacting my, you're impacting my side hustle right now. So anyway,
I mean, I think not only just that, but you know, the economy in general, I think, is so hard for people right now. And, you know, the first thing that's going to go is stuff like this. It's like, it's not a priority. Yeah. It's not a need. It's a want. So it's easier to be like, yeah, you know, sorry, I'm 15 bucks. I got to eat.
And I get it. Like, I don't begrudge anybody, right? I'll sell all the slabs on these shelves to support, you know, making this book before I don't make it. I mean, and that's just, you know, it's just how it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if that's what I had to do. So, I mean, like I said, the issue 3, I think there's 4 pages of art that we're waiting on that are being finished up. I do my own lettering. I learned how to letter. That was a pretty cool experience. You know, I bought Nate Plico's from Blambot. I bought his book and, you know, watched all his YouTube stuff and got, you know, the hustle is real. I've got a friend that works for Adobe that got me Adobe Illustrator for screaming cheap. I paid for 1 year. I paid what I was paying per month. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I do all my own lettering. And so there's like 4 issues of art that's left to be inked and colored. And then when I get that back, so I fully expect issue 3 to to be out by December, mm-hmm. and then and we'll roll right into issue four. So
nice.
Yeah,
right on. The well, quickly before we're gonna get out of here soon, I do have I want to ask you about, you said you got back into comic books in 2019, mm-hmm. with like House of X, Krakoa era X-Men.
Yeah.
I'm like a X-Men guy. That was my main thing. I've got I always tell people I think I may have the largest personal collection of X-Men comic books. I think I might
really?
At least contend for yeah. So pretty much anything X-Men adjacent, I have complete runs with, like most newsstands variants also.
Wow.
I mean, like even I'm talking even like Dazzler, Captain Britain, crap like that. And I'm only missing number 1 and 4 of the original Uncanny run. So like I mean literally it's probably 35 long boxes full of just X-Men related stuff.
That's pretty cool.
So
that's impressive.
I kind of came back into reading around that time also and got into the Krakoa stuff. So like where are you at with what are your feelings on this?
So I'm not a fan of the Krakoa stuff. And the reason why is because to me, the X-Men were always... So, and this isn't just an X-Men problem. It's kind of a comic book problem in general is like when I was reading the X-Men, they had secret identities, right? Scott Summers. Not everybody knew that Scott Summers was Cyclops. Not everybody knew that Jean Grey was Marvel Girl. And,
right.
You know, and so... You know, and then all of a sudden they've got their own island and their own nation and they're doing these galas and the Hellfire galas and the, you know, and it just, you know, I'm not a fan of the whole let's make Magneto a good guy and Professor X is the bad guy. Like that was a little weird mm-hmm. and how that whole thing. And then all the bad guys were good guys because they all lived together in peace and harmony on Krakoa. And,
yeah.
You know, like. Apocalypse, who is like the worst of the worst, is there hanging out with him, and I'm
yeah.
like, what is going on? Like, it was just, I don't know, it was super bizarre to me. And then, you know, I listened to Liefeld's podcast, and you know, I don't agree probably with about half of what he says. Like sometimes he's just so like out in left field that I'm just like, all right, bro, it's what do my kids say? It's not that deep.
Yeah.
But,
He also is like, he's like a fucking jaded ex now with Marvel where he just wants to hate
horrible.
On everything.
Oh,
Marvel.
Absolutely
just,
horrible.
Cause they,
but
you know, they scorned him.
Yeah. I will say the point that he made on Krakoa, I do agree with. And that's if Krakoa had been like a 1 year thing, or even just a huge like crossover event where it like it happened and then it was done, I think it probably would have played a lot better. But even more so than how much I didn't like Krakoa. And I will say too, part of it I think is because I jumped in it there, but like the whole Nimrod stuff, I didn't really have a whole lot of history on that. And the, you know, the, what were they? They were like the Sentinels, but they were trapped in like this pocket universe or stuff. That whole storyline that was going on was
what was that called?
So
anyway.
Yes, so I was doing a lot of Googling, like who the hell are these guys? But I think probably worse than Krakoa was how they came out of Krakoa, which was supposed to be this new beginning and like maybe like a soft reboot. And I think that they fumbled that even harder than they did the Krakoa stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think my take on Krakoa is the biggest. So like, as much as I am an X-Men fan, I've never been like a purist of anything where I think there's, you know, there should be this status quo we have to commit to. Cause that's, to me, that's boring. You know, like the Outback era is one of my favorite eras in X-Men because it was so so wild, so weird, an unconventional lineup, you know. But so I'm like, okay, I'm down with like the concept. You can do whatever you want. It's just execution to me. I think one of the big problems is as brilliant as Jonathan Hickman is, his fault is his best attribute is his world building, and it is also his fault. Because he gets so enamored with world building that he forgets to tell the stories in between. And he created all these really interesting concepts, and then we went years without ever exploring them or touching on any of them. But it really hit me. It was tough to kind of swallow, where I'm like, all right, so all the X-Men, all the good mutants, all the bad mutants, all the neutral mutants on one island. So there's no opposition. You know, they can all be resurrected, so there's no stakes if anyone dies.
That was the other thing. Yeah, you know, none.
They have unlimited money. They can do. It's like there's no pressure here. There's no, like, it doesn't. None of this. Nothing that happens has any real stakes. You know, that's.
And then they go to fucking. Then they go to fucking Mars. Like, what was that? Yeah, like.
Yeah, we're gonna terraform Mars now. That's a mutant planet.
I was just like, where did that come from? The other thing is the pages of like the prose writing that were just randomly interjected into the issues.
The info pages,
that completely would just pull, pages, even if I was enjoying a story, that would just pull me out. And I'm like, okay, that's too many words, man. Yeah. I read comics because I don't want to read a whole lot of words. What is going on here? And so I never really got that either.
Yeah, there was, I mean, there was some good that came out of it. There was some fun stuff, but they really, it just seems like they had a decent concept and then had no clue where to go with it. I wouldn't have mind if they would have kept it as long as they did, if they would have done something more interesting. But really the most interesting part to me was when at the end of the Krakoa era, when, you know, after the last Hellfire Gala and everything was kind of blown apart, they were scattered to the wind. Kitty's doing the revenge thing. Mm-hmm. That felt the most exciting of all of it, because I'm like, oh yeah, this is where the X-Men are at best, when their back is against the wall, the world's against them, and they're against all odds trying to defeat their foes. And in that lasted a couple issues, and then it was over.
I'm with you. So, and I think part of my other problem just overall with the X-Men is like, the whole X family, and it's the same problem with the Bat family books, is if I want to read X-Men, right, I don't want to read 19 other issues that are coming out that month to understand what's going on, right? Like, if it's a crossover, I got it. You know, there's once or twice a year where I'm going to have to, you know, expand the comic book buying budget for those couple of months to buy all the crossover stuff if I want to read the whole thing. But the way that they were doing it, like, you had to read all of it. And now they've doubled down on that, or tripled down on that with this, which I'm not reading any of the new stuff that's coming out with this Age of Revelation stuff.
I have no clue.
But I mean, I just, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot to have to read and keep up with that story and go, okay, hold on. So Cyclops was here and he died here, but they resurrected him in this book. And, you know, and then there's six different characters that are all Wolverine, and we call them all Wolverine, the dude Wolverine, the chick Wolverine, everybody's called Wolverine. Yeah. Like, I don't know. It's crazy.
I think the gross, there was a, what I really felt was egregious was the like gross mischaracterization of certain people, you know, specifically like Storm just became like this soulless, shell of a person with no emotion.
Right.
And, you know, it's one of the benefits of, you know, I'm sure this, you know, you grew up on Claremont X-Men too. Yep. One of the benefits of him writing it for so long is that these characters were consistent, and they did change and evolve and grow, but they did so organically and with reason, you know. I've always said that I think the death of the X-Men as we know it was with Grant Morrison. And not to say, like, I think Grant Morrison's X-Men run is really good comic books. I think it's really bad X-Men comic books. Like, I enjoy reading it in a vacuum, but reading it in the continuity of X-Men as from what's come before and what came after, it's really bad. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, 100%. I think maybe part of the problem is, too, is I think our generation, and I'll just speak for myself, I live in a very nostalgic mind frame, right? Like you said, Claremont, right? That's what I want. Like, my brother and I had this conversation. We have had this conversation multiple times. I'd give it all up. I'd give this laptop and this Yeti mic and my cell phone and all of this. I'd give all this technology up to go back to 1989 and just stay there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like going to Marvelous Comics, you know, buying back issues of X Factor in, you know, in the back issue room, you know, that's, and because that's, and so that's what I want my X-Men comic books to be. And I get that we have to evolve, right? Like I, cause you said it, if you're just in the school and you're going out and you're fighting the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants every single issue, right? Like it just, it gets repetitive. And I get that. But at the same time, so we're like, oh, we need new stories. We need new X-Men stories. So they give us this big, like sprawling new X-Men story. And then we're like, oh, this sucks.
Yeah.
Take us back to the school. So they really can't win. I don't think, however they go. And it's a tough position to be in. I didn't like it. But at the same time, maybe it's time to go back to the school because we've been away from that for so long. Maybe it's time to, I mean, I'd be curious to see their, Marvel is starting to hype this, what do they call, Armageddon that Chip Zdarsky's going to write, which
Armageddon people Origin are, or something like that. Yeah.
Well, people are saying it might be a Marvel, you know, a Marvel reboot, which that never works, but I mean, I guess we'll see.
Didn't
you know?
They try that with Secret Wars in 2014 or 15 or whatever too, though? They tried to do a soft reboot then, and they kind of positioned it as like, okay, we're finally doing the reboot, and then they kind of I don't know if they chickened out or it just wasn't as, you know, so yeah, I don't know what this thing they just announced is, but I don't think a reboot is the answer, because for me it's part of the reason I mean, I like some DC stuff, but it's always confusing because I'm like, what the fuck is real? What counts? What matters? You know,
like nothing, you know? Nothing. It's like, you know, the points don't, and the points don't matter, and everybody's a winner. Like it's just, it's literally, yeah, it's, I don't know, but like, that DC's a whole nother thing. They, some of the stuff, putting all their eggs in the Tom Taylor basket at DC, just completely, like they lost me.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I can more get on board with like just being like, listen, sliding time scale. Yeah. Punisher was in Vietnam. Now it was, you know, Iraq. Then it's, or, you know, first Iraq. Yeah. Then it's Afghanistan, right. Whatever. Like I can just do the math. It's
sure.
Fine. But we don't need to reboot this whole thing, because that's just a new, it's not going to fix the problem. You still have to have like better storytelling and better, because like, what do they do? They reboot it and then the X-Men are back at the school doing the, like, what do you,
Cyclops is 17 again, and you know, and after running after Jean Grey, I'll tell you, complete just out of left field. So I went back and read some old X-Men books on the app, right? Because, dude, Charles Xavier was trying to get in Marvel Girl's pants back in the day. Like, oh, that completely. Yeah. I mean, I was just like, what is that about?
There's that one panel where he's like thinking, he's like, ah, oh, you'll never know how I feel about you.
Yeah.
It's like
in
issue number 7 or something like that. Or, and you're like, whoa.
What is going on?
She's like 14, dude. She's supposed to be in the first issue. You know?
Come on, Stan. Let's get it together here. But I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't, like you said, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know. You know, I'd like to say, here's the answer, man. You make an uncanny X-Men and an X-Factor and an X-Force, and you leave it there. You do 3 books a month. Oh, and a Wolverine, because he gets his own book, right? You do 4 books a month, and, you know, or you do what Amazing Spider-Man is doing right now. Are you reading Amazing Spider-Man?
I am, yeah. I like Joe Kelly a lot, so.
So I do too, and I love how they've got like Peter Parker's in space with Rocket Raccoon. That's a pairing that I didn't know that I need, you know, but I'm digging it. And then you do the Norman Osborn, and it's bi-monthly, so you know, this week you get this story, and then this week you get this story. Like, I kind of dig that. I'm, you know, it's an interesting, and eventually those stories are going to collide, right? I mean, that's what we has to happen. So, but I do like how they're doing that. So, you know, maybe maybe you look at doing that with some of your X books where you go, you know, you do X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, and you just go bi-monthly, and this story, you know, whoever your writer is, not Gail Simone, but somebody else is writing, this the whole thing, but you got this artist doing this book and this artist, and it's two different teams and they're doing different things. And, you know, so I don't know what the right answer is. Cause you certainly can't tell Marvel do less books because they're not going to do that because they're, you know.
Yeah. More books is more sales. But I mean, it's like, you know, it's, I think it's like more quality is what, if it was really better, you'd have more people sticking around. Like, they're like, oh, we do more number ones because number ones sell. I'm like, yeah, number twos would sell a lot also if you've made a good book. You know, here's an example. I don't know if you read this era of X-Men, but I am a huge fan. Like, Mike Carey did a run with Chris Bachalo and Humberto Ramos in the, around 2009, probably same time Brubaker was on Uncanny. And it was, I mean, I'm such a Chris Bachalo fan. I'll read anything he does. But it was like this darker, almost X-Force vibe, Strike Force, Rogue, Sabretooth, Cannonball, Mystique, and Cable. Like, what a crazy team, right?
Yeah.
And to me, that is one of the, it only ended because they did the Messiah Complex, and then it became X-Men Legacy, and things changed. But that run, I'm like, this is one of the best runs on X-Men, and it's so against type for an X-Men book. So it's like, the proof is there. Like, and at the same time, Ed Brubaker was doing a whole year of them, Uncanny X-Men in space with the Shi'ar, and you're like, so it's not really where they're at. It's not really like,
I would love to see more of, like, that's another story I'd like to see more of is fighting the Imperial Guard and the Shi'ar. Like, I would be there for that too.
Exactly. You know, the point I'm trying to make is like, the lineups can be unconventional, the settings and the premises can be unconventional. It doesn't have to be status quo, but if you're writing good stories, like, the fans will eat them up, you know. But yes, they have this fear of like, no, we have to do something super crazy, and then we have to reboot it, or we have to do status quo, and you can't. It's like, no, you just need. I mean, again, you X-Men was Rogue, Cable, Mystique, Sabretooth, and Cannonball. Like, that's their team on.
Yeah,
you know. So it's doable. You just gotta, you know, you just gotta get over the fear and make something good.
I definitely think, I mean, especially at Marvel, I think it's time for a leadership change. I think Asaki Kurosawa, also known as C.B. Sobolski, has been there for, you know, just too long. I don't know. I think it's time. It's just time for something else. I mean, at least in that X office. Who's the main editor? I can't. Is it Tom
Brevoort?
Yeah, Brevoort. Is he still the? I think he's still the main X editor too.
See, the thing is, he came over when they did this reboot because he was like the Avengers guy forever, and then kind of just Marvel Universe guru. But I mean, he's a guy that, like, I don't know why they did that, because he has like a disdain for the X-Men. And he even said in this recently, when they were canceling a bunch of series, they're canceling Psylocke and Laura Kinney Wolverine.
Yeah.
And people asked him, what about Magic? And they're like, well, it's selling really well. Fans love it, but we're probably going to cancel it because I don't like that character. And I'm like, are you fucking, what the fuck is your, are you stupid?
Yeah. Like, that's wild. Yeah. I mean, but that's, you know, but if that's what you're competing with as a creator, like, if I was the creator on Magic, I'd be pissed.
Yeah.
Like, really, my editor's going to cancel this because he doesn't like the creator, even though we're crushing it, you know? So I don't know. It's like, I feel for the creators at Marvel, and listen, so Punisher's my jam. I mean, and I love what I love that there is Punisher right now, because Marvel has stayed so far away from the Punisher for so long because he's problematic.
Yeah.
The whole thing with the skull, and you have cops wearing it's the skull in the real world, and, you know, Marine Corps scout snipers, whatever. I mean, so, and I actually like the Punisher stuff that's coming out right now. The Red Band is really good.
Ben Percy was made to write the Punisher. in my opinion.
I agree.
That's a perfect
match. And so far, so good. So, you know, it's like, I don't know. I've said many times that I would love to write the Punisher someday, but I don't know if I want to write the Punisher because I don't know if I want to be constrained by the nonsense that, you know, it would take to be a writer at Marvel. You know, I mean, you listen to some of them, like I'm a big Stephanie Phillips fan, not necessarily of her stuff. Cause I, you know, I'm not really a Spider-Gwen kind of a reader, but I like her. Yeah. I like watching her TikToks. I like interacting with her. She seems like a super cool
person. She's not.
Yeah. You know, but, I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could fit in their box that they, you know, that they want people to, I'd rather go write my own story. That's the Punisher here. This would have been my take on the Punisher, right? I'll give you this for free. So
he comes out of the closet.
My name is not Tom Taylor. I would not be writing that story. Trust me. But talking about your sliding timeline, I would have done an old man Frank story, right? I would have done the Punisher because at the end of that Jason Aaron abomination where he was the ninja and he was at the charge of the hand and he was the devil and all that stuff. And they at the end, like, this is the craziest ending. Did you read that story?
I did. Like, I read the first, I don't know if I read the whole thing. I know I read the first six issues. I don't know if I read the whole thing.
Bro, at the end of it, Captain America, Wolverine, Moon Knight, and Doctor Strange, just like the most random team ever, shows up and they're like, we can't allow you to get away with all of this. And they send him to Weird World. Like, it was literally like, what is going on right now? And so literally the last panels of the 12th issue is Frank in Weird World with these two little kids. That's the end of it, right? And so now Red Band, we're picking it back up. He's back in our dimension somehow. But my take on it would have been, he comes back from Weird World and he's aged out, right? He's like 75. He's like the age that he would have been had he been in Vietnam.
Sure.
And he's living in the burbs, right? His wife, Maria, because she came back to life in the 12 issues. The very weird, but not his kids, just his wife. She still has bullet hole scars in her face where she got shot, but she's alive. And right, they're divorced. She files for divorce when she finds out that he's like a mass murderer. But anyway, so like my take would have been like he's living in the burbs, whatever, and he's not killing anymore, but he's mentoring this guy who is now the new Punisher. And it would have been like an old man Frank, but then that guy gets killed and then Frank has to throw the skull back on and go and kick ass. So like the first several issues would have been Frank like mentoring this dude, like almost like if he was this dude's microchip. But then the dude gets killed, or maybe he doesn't get killed, he just gets kidnapped, whatever. And so Frank throws the skull on and goes all old man Frank on him. That would have been my pitch for the Punisher.
Yeah.
So
I dig it. Yeah. Well, I am like I said, I'm glad the Punisher's back. I think Ben Percy was made for something like that. His Wolverine run was great. I think his Ghost Rider run was great. So that's kind of the character that, like,
totally I agree,
lines up. So, all right. Well, Jason, tell everyone where they can find you, find the Kickstarter, find, you know, follow you for more information, Instagram, any of that stuff.
For sure. So on Instagram, I'm at Alamo City Comics. So that's a great place to find me. The Kickstarter, if you go to Kickstarter and search Mercer 3 or Mercer and find the third one, then that'll take you to the Kickstarter. And then also on the web, I'm at AlamoCityComicsLLC.com. And that's my storefront and where all that kind of stuff. But really right now, the help that we need is on the Kickstarter. All the info for Mercer's on the Kickstarter. We've got some art up there. There's four covers that we're doing. This is the first time we've done four covers. We've done three for the first two issues. But I've got a fourth cover this time that's a Kickstarter-only exclusive. You can only get it through the Kickstarter. And I'm not going to be selling them at any conventions or in the online store. So, and it's actually a piece of interior art from the first issue that I just absolutely love. It's a full panel where you first meet Mercer. He's kind of standing over the bad guy, and it's pretty dope. So so I turned that into an exclusive cover for Kickstarter, but that's really where we need the help. If you're San Antonio local, along with Deese, I'll be at Comic Arts San Antonio on Saturday, the 15th of November, be there all day long. I'll be selling issues 1 and 2. I've got copies of all 3 covers of both of those issues, and then we'll also be plugging the Kickstarter there as well. So definitely look forward to seeing everybody. So
all right, well guys, give them a follow, check out the Kickstarter, donate, subscribe, get your kick a little money down, get your indie comics. There's digital versions, physical versions, all ways to catch up, so don't worry about getting in at number 3. You can get the other 2 issues on the Kickstarter also. So check it out. We'll drop some links in the description of the show and everything with that too, so you'll be able to find it. And that's going to be it, guys. We are going to get out of here for today. Again, go to deesecomedy.com. Check out everything going on across the network. Live shows. I've got some more dates for the end of the year. So it's all Texas local around San Antonio. So come check it out. I don't want to have to stay in a hotel the rest of the year. That's what I decided. So if I can sleep in my own bed, I'll do a show. Otherwise, I'm fucking staying home. But come to some of the comedy shows. Lots of stuff coming up in 2026 with that, though. And then Killstand number 3 coming soon. Go to inferno.earth on Instagram for information on that. You can pre-order it on Inferno Earth, our inferno.earth, the website. And conventions, more, all that good stuff. So that's it, guys, for the Social Hour. And for Jason, that's all for today. And we will see you all next week.